Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In 1977, long before the world started hearing about the looming climate crisis, James Black, an Exxon senior scientist, delivered a sobering message to the company's executives. He warned them that, quote, carbon dioxide from the world's use of fossil fuels would warm the planet and could eventually endanger humanity, end quote. So here we are four decades later. Today, the overwhelming majority of climate scientists agree with Mr. Black. The burning of fossil fuels has been the major cause of warming of the planet. So how did Exxon manage to keep the adverse impacts of its industry a secret for so many years? Two separate in-depth exposés by nonprofit news organization Inside Climate News, the LA Times, and the Columbia School of Journalism have revealed Exxon's early internal discussions about climate change. The reports focus on interactions at the highest echelons, presentations for the rank and file, plans to manufacture doubt about the reality of global warming its own scientists had once confirmed, and then intense lobbying efforts to block federal and international action to control greenhouse gas emissions. These explosive reports have sparked the Exxon New campaign by environmental activists and an investigation by New York's Attorney General. Two California House Democrats, Ted Lieu and Mark DeSalinier, have also asked the Justice Department to launch a probe to find out if ExxonMobil broke the law. And on October 20th, Senator and presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders sent a letter to Attorney General Loretta Lynch calling for an investigation into corporate fraud at Exxon. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about what Exxon actually knew, and also, when did it know it? Is it time for Congress to investigate Exxon about its misinformation and denial campaigns to bury the truth? Who has the power to make that happen? And what could result? Today, we are joined by Neela Banerjee, a reporter for Inside Climate News. Neela is part of the investigative team that exposed Exxon's climate research decades ago and how the corporation worked at the forefront of climate denial by manufacturing doubt. And Neela Banerjee joins us from Washington. Hi, Neela. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. And earlier this summer, the Union of Concerned Scientists also revealed that Exxon was aware of the threat posed by climate change as early as 1981. Despite internal deliberations and warnings from scientists, the report found that Exxon's lobbyists continue to fight climate rules and spread misinformation about climate science. Elliot Nagin is a senior writer at the Union of Concerned Scientists, a nonprofit science advocacy organization. And Elliot also joins us from Washington. Hi, Elliot. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. So let's start off with you, Neela. Exxon has clearly been shaken by these recent investigations because they are getting a lot of attention in the media. And talk a little bit about what strikes you the most about how this story has been unraveled, because Exxon's Vice President for Public and Government Affairs, Kenneth Cohen, wrote a letter to the Columbia University president. The students, amazing students, have done reporting on this, basically telling him that the probe will cost the university dearly. Through its foundation, Exxon gave $219,000 to Columbia in 2014 as part of a matching gift program. This is according to Politico. So what strikes you about how this is all unraveling?
Well, I think what I find so interesting is and heartening in some ways is that the narrative that we have been able to uncover from 1977 to 1986, and then the work that Columbia has done basically from 86 onward, that it's resonated with people, including policymakers and presidential candidates, as much as it has. I think the sense of surprise that we felt when we found the documents that showed that Exxon was doing rigorous, conscientious research in the late 70s and early 80s, and that other people share in that same sense of surprise, given the fact that Exxon was so active in promoting confusion about climate change starting in the late 80s onward.
And what about you, Elliot? The Union of Concerned Scientists revealed that Exxon was aware of the threat posed by climate change as early as 1981. And we'll talk about the report that your organization released, which is based on documents and leaked internal emails and memos. But first off, what strikes you the most about how this story has unraveled?
Well, what's interesting to me is how contradictory some of the statements the spokespeople from ExxonMobil have been making in recent weeks. They don't seem to have their talking points in order. At one moment, a spokesman says that they are not funding climate denier organizations. We've documented years ago that they had been funding dozens of think tanks and advocacy groups to basically misinform and the public about the reality of climate change. Another spokesperson said, "Yes, we are funding them." So they don't seem to have their story straight, which is really interesting. Given this is one of the top five Fortune 500 companies, and they don't seem to have their own message worked out yet.
Well, and so let's go back and talk about these exposés. James Black, an Exxon senior scientist, is being quoted in a lot of articles, and he delivered this sobering message to company execs, warning that carbon dioxide from the world's use of fossil fuels would warm the planet and could eventually endanger humanity. Neela, tell us, who was James Black, and what was his role as an Exxon senior scientist?
So James Black was one of the leading scientists in Exxon Research and Engineering. Exxon Research and Engineering was a unit in northern New Jersey, it's still there, that did a whole range of research, except for stuff that actually had to do with exploration and production. And in the 1970s, Exxon's chairman wanted Exxon Research and Engineering to become like the Bell Labs of energy. So they did research into things that just weren't contributing to the bottom line, but that could help Exxon figure out its role in the energy picture 30, 40, 50 years down the line. Why Mr. Black became interested in climate change, I don't know. It looks like he was interested in meteorology and weather and human influences on it as far back as the 60s, and we documented that. But he made a presentation to the management committee of Exxon. That is the top-level management, the board of director level, including the chairman, in 1977, where he very candidly lay out what the emerging science was saying on climate change. And that is that CO2 concentrations were increasing in the atmosphere. Scientists at the time thought it was largely driven by use of fossil fuels. And as CO2 concentrations increased, that would warm the planet. And that could have some very grave consequences for countries' economies and agriculture. So that's who James Black was, and that's what he presented. Mr. Black died in the 1980s, so we haven't been able to speak to him, but we spoke to his family members, and they said, you know, that their dad was on to, you know, climate change, was very interested in it way back.
And in your piece, you quote James Black as saying that very quick action was needed. In a 1978 summary, he wrote, quote, "Present thinking holds that man has a time window of 5 to 10 years before the need for hard decisions regarding changes in energy strategies might become critical," end quote. I mean, he wrote that in 1978. How did company executives respond to this?
That part we don't know, because what we have are enough documents to trace the arc of the discussions, but we don't have every single document by any stretch of the imagination. And maybe the New York Attorney General subpoena can yield those other pieces of the puzzle. What we do know is that Exxon stayed quite interested in this topic. That the men whom he informed on the vice president level were engaged in this issue. They were being constantly apprised of the emerging science, and they also, you know, had a scientific back and forth with their rank and file researchers. That's the first thing. And the second thing is that Exxon was so interested in this that they launched their own in-house ambitious research effort. And from what we have seen so far, no other company had a research effort on the same level or the same scale as Exxon did.
And also, when you look at, you know, what else can you tell us just about what they knew at that time? Because when these headlines came out, it was shared all over social media. And, you know, what else do we need to know about what happened during that time?
Well, I mean, you know, what's so surprising is that Exxon was aware that if global temperatures rose, that the effects could be grave, if not catastrophic. I mean, catastrophic was a word that we ran into several times in the documents from the late 70s to the early 80s, that Exxon scientists and executives used. You really didn't see the hints of the kind of denial and skepticism that you would see later. I mean, they raised questions, but the questions we discovered were very much in the mainstream of the questions that scientists and academia were raising about climate science. So that was one thing. And they understood, you know, in great detail what this would mean, that you would have sea level rise, that you could have drought and changes in precipitation, that agriculture would be affected, that disease would be affected. Exxon's understanding of climate science and the effects of global warming was quite sophisticated as that of researchers in academia and in the government.
And Elliot, earlier this summer, Union of Concerned Scientists published a report based on documents and leaked internal emails and memos related to some of the world's largest fossil fuel companies, in addition to Exxon, BP, Chevron, Conoco, Peabody, Phillips, and Shell, and these spanned over the course of 27 years. What do those memos reveal? Is it similar to what we're learning about Exxon?
Well, we weren't able to document it to the great depth that Neil and her folks did, but we did show that, for example, just within the last year or so, Chevron, which is a big player in California and obviously one of the top Fortune 500 companies, created a number of phony grassroots groups to scare Californians about the proposal to in the legislature there to cut oil use by 50% over the next several decades. In other words, ExxonMobil is not the only player here, but it is probably next to the along with the Koch brothers, one of the most company that has done the most disinform the public about the reality of climate change.
And Neela, is that what your reporting has revealed, that Exxon has done the most?
You know, I think that's kind of hard to quantify, partly because not all the numbers are known for all of the companies. But what we can say is that in 1989, fossil fuel companies and big manufacturers formed this thing called the Global Climate Coalition. And it was led largely by the American Petroleum Institute and by Exxon. And Exxon was a big player in API then. Exxon had this storehouse of knowledge that they built through their own climate research through the 70s and 80s. And the Global Climate Coalition, despite its very green-sounding name, was tracking what was happening with the international and U.S. response to climate change, both with the administration of the first George H.W. Bush and then with the U.N. And they wanted to delay action on reducing emissions, and that was basically not by buying into a lot of theories that you hear from deniers about sunspots or water vapor, or natural cycles, but they instead very astutely hammered away at the uncertainty around climate science, despite the fact that the science was growing more certain. And so Exxon was definitely an enormous influence and you know, the leader of that effort, and that was one of the earliest efforts.
And according to reports, the opening of the investigation of Exxon by the New York Attorney General's office into what we're talking about, the company's record on climate change, could result in legal inquiries into other oil companies. Neela, what are you hearing about that?
Well, you know, we don't hear much because they're the Attorney General and they don't talk. But you know, we have gleaned a few things from their public comments, right? So first of all, right around the time that they announced that they had issued the subpoena to Exxon, they settled with Peabody Coal about statements that Peabody Coal had made on climate change. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is that according to Attorney General Schneiderman of New York, they had they've been looking at Exxon it's not according to him, but his office rather. They had been looking at Exxon for about a year when our investigation and that of Columbia University hit the internet, and so that made the time ripe for them to act. So this is not something that that just our work prompted them to move on, but in fact that they've been looking at it for a while. But you know, my expectation is that this is going to drag out for a really long time. Exxon was supposed to deliver documents on, I think, December 4th, which was last Friday. From what we've heard, they haven't delivered those documents yet. I mean, it's 40 years worth of documents. It's going to take them a while, and they'll probably also fight levels of disclosure in the courts, right? So it's, you know, this, I think, you know, you have to watch this space for quite a while going forward.
Neela Banerjee is a reporter with Inside Climate News. It's a nonprofit news organization. She is part of the investigative team that exposed Exxon's cutting-edge climate research decades ago in the late 70s and how the corporation worked at the forefront of climate denial by manufacturing doubt about the scientific consensus that its own scientists had confirmed. We're also joined by Elliot Nagin, senior writer with the Union of Concerned Scientists, a nonprofit science advocacy organization. Earlier this summer, the union revealed that Exxon was aware of the threat posed by climate change as early as 1981. And despite internal deliberations, the report found Exxon's lobbyists continue to fight climate rules and spread misinformation about climate science. Last year, Exxon's net income, according to MarketWatch, was $32 billion. And last year, Exxon spent $659,000 on congressional climate science denier political campaigns and almost $2 million on 15 denier think tanks, advocacy groups, and trade associations. And if you'd like to join us, what questions do you have about what Exxon knew and when it knew it? And then what are your thoughts about these calls for investigations? So far, there is an investigation by New York's Attorney General. Bernie Sanders is calling for an investigation into corporate fraud. Two California House Democrats want the DOJ to launch a probe. So what are your thoughts about these investigations, and how do you think Exxon should be held responsible for the information that it had back in 1977? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. So, Elliot, I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
You know, let me jump in here for a second just to augment what I said before about ExxonMobil. ExxonMobil wasn't acting alone. Our report that we put out earlier this year pointed the finger at other fossil fuel companies who were also involved in this disinformation campaign. They included British Petroleum, which is now known as BP, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, the coal giant Peabody Energy, and Royal Dutch Shell. And we found that that all these companies were fully aware of the reality of climate change, but they continued to spend tens of millions of dollars to promote denier arguments that they knew to be wrong. Mm. So it would be really interesting to see if there are other investigations launched into the activities of other fossil fuel companies besides ExxonMobil.
Well, how do you see this playing out? Because if you've got this massive corporation like Exxon that knew in 1977 that carbon dioxide from the world's use of fossil fuels would warm the planet and could eventually endanger humanity, how do you hold a company like this responsible? We're just getting an email from Armand who says, since hundreds of people have already died, I think that all people involved with the cover-up should be charged with mass murder, and that Exxon should be dissolved of its profits, and the profits should be used to mitigate the effects of global warming. How do you see that playing out, Elliot?
Well, a number of people on Capitol Hill, including Sheldon Whitehouse, senator from Rhode Island, who wrote an op-ed about this in the Washington Post a few months ago, have called for the Justice Department to launch an investigation along the same lines that they launched years ago under racketeering laws against the tobacco industry. There are plenty of parallels here. The question is, the question that Attorney General Schneiderman of New York is looking at is whether the ExxonMobil specifically defrauded its shareholders and the public by withholding information from them about the effects climate change could have on its own business, as well as there are other things he's looking into. So the question comes down to, is this what some people call a free speech question? The company is allowed to say whatever it wants, or did it actually break the law? So there has to be a specific law that it broke. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't comment on that, but my organization welcomes investigations on the part of the Justice Department and other attorneys general around the country to really get with subpoena power to take a look at what ExxonMobil and other fossil fuel companies knew and what they were saying they knew at the time.
Well, since you brought up tobacco and the similarities, we have a caller on that. Let's hear from Elliot in San Francisco. Hi, Elliot. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to say that, you know, first of all, it does seem that the basic behavior is the same as the tobacco companies, and therefore, if the tobacco companies broke the law that the that Exxon has. But my question to the panelists, you know, given that the tobacco companies affected only tobacco users, is it alarmist to say that this is a crime against humanity? Because, you know, we're all living in the same climate.
Neela, what are lawyers and scientists telling you?
Lawyers and scientists aren't, well, scientists aren't saying very much about it. Lawyers, you know, we've spoken to people who are, who worked in the Justice Department, and they said this would be a big lift. This would be a tall order. And I think one of the reasons, you know, for the Justice Department and others to prove, and I think one of the reasons is that Exxon, when its scientists were doing their research in the 70s and 80s, did not suppress the research, nor has it suppressed its research throughout. What happened, however, was that in the 70s and 80s, it didn't take a big policy position. And when it did, it was quite measured. It was within the realm of accepted science then. Its executives acknowledged climate change and a move to renewable energy at some point in the future. And so so in that sense, the parallel with tobacco is not quite exact, right? And what Exxon has since argued, you know, after the investigations came out, is what Elliot was saying before, Elliot Nagin, and that is that you know, they did their science, but they took a policy position against regulations and laws that they thought were bad ideas, and they argue, and they're making a First Amendment free speech argument in that way. So it is going to be harder to use the tobacco template on Exxon now. But that doesn't mean, you know, the tobacco way isn't the only way to go. So, but it's not as at first glance it looks like the same thing. But really, if you read the stories, you'll see that you know, it wasn't like they told their executives and the executives suppressed this stuff. They didn't. It's just that Exxon in the late 80s changed course, and their executives started to speak out on climate change in a way that that confused the public, and they also funded all of these groups that promoted denial and gave this air of legitimacy.
Elliot, what about that?
Well, again, it's really difficult to really get into what they're culpable for. What are they guilty of? It's my organization. Well, like I said, we welcome investigations, but we're not a legal organization. We can't really speak to that. To Neela's point, what's interesting is that while the company was hedging its bets and constantly pushing uncertainty, that the climate models were uncertain. We don't really know if carbon dioxide if the problem is only coming from fossil fuels. They would constantly throw in questions about what we know and what we don't know. But they were funding, since 1998, all through last year, they spent more than $30 million on roughly more than 60 organizations, who think tanks and advocacy groups, who have been very clear about the fact that they don't believe climate change is a problem. They're all over the map, but they constantly denigrate and disparage climate science and call into questions the consensus that scientific institutions have around the world that, indeed, human activity is driving climate change and we need to do something about it. Next to the Koch brothers, the ExxonMobil has spent more than any other fossil fuel company on this denier network.
Between 2007 and 2014, the company spent $10 million on climate science denying organizations. Not that much money for a corporation that brought in $32 billion last year.
Well, it props up these organizations. The amount of money is compared to how much money the company makes is not relevant. What's relevant is that it pays for these people. These are liars for hire, if you will. Mm. It pays for these people who wind up getting quoted by newspapers and television networks and radio stations, who are basically treated as if they're independent entities, but they're really PR agents for ExxonMobil.
Right, and I'll ask you both about that right after the break. Today we're joined by Elliot Nagin, senior writer with the Union of Concerned Scientists, and Neela Banerjee, a reporter with Inside Climate News. We are talking about Exxon. When did it know that carbon dioxide from the use of fossil fuels could eventually endanger humanity, according to one of its own scientists it knew back in 1977. There are calls for investigations. What could result from these? It's your call. We'll be back after this.
This is your call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective that hasn't been heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, you're welcome to join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or a question on the show's website, yourcallradio.org. If you're doing your holiday shopping online this year, please take a moment to give a gift that will keep great radio coming for the whole community in the new year. Click on the Donate Now button at KALW.org and support a community resource that you depend on and believe in. Thank you and best wishes from all of us here at KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will continue our week-long series on climate change and the talks in Paris by talking about which countries and cities are leading the way in renewable energy development. Green power is a major talking point at the Climate Change Summit in Paris. But who's leading the charge to reduce their emissions? Which countries are succeeding in implementing renewable energy resources? That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about ExxonMobil and what it knew back in 1977. James Black, an Exxon senior scientist, delivered a message to company execs warning that carbon dioxide would warm the planet and could eventually endanger humanity. And so how did Exxon manage to keep the adverse effects of its industry a secret for so many decades? We're joined by Neela Banerjee, a reporter with Inside Climate News. She's part of the investigative team that exposed Exxon's climate research decades ago. And Elliot Nagin is a senior writer at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Earlier this summer, the concerned scientists revealed that Exxon was aware of the threat posed by climate change as early as 1981. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What questions do you have about Exxon and what it knew? What were your reactions when you saw these explosive reports? What are your thoughts about calls for investigations? And how would you hold a company like Exxon responsible for this? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And now, before the break, Neela, we were talking with Elliot about how all of this is being reported and the fact that for, quote, balance, the media tends to give these climate deniers, although they don't do it as much as they used to, but almost equal time, right? So they'd say, well, for the other perspective, let's bring on this professor, and they rarely talk about ties to oil. Now, what are your thoughts about this? Because Greenpeace just came out with an undercover investigation exposing how fossil fuel companies are secretly paying academics at leading universities to write research that expressed doubt about climate science. Posing as representatives of oil and gas, reporters from Greenpeace UK asked academics from Princeton and Penn State to write papers promoting the benefits of CO2. And the professors agreed to write the reports and said they didn't need to disclose the source of funding. Yesterday, Senator Ted Cruz, who was interviewed about climate change on NPR this morning, brought Professor William Harper to the Senate. He's a leading climate skeptic academic, and he agreed to write a report for a Middle Eastern oil company on the benefits of CO2 and to allow the firm to keep the source of the funding secret, although we didn't hear about that in the interview this morning. So what do you think about how reporters are, you know, giving Ted Cruz a platform without talking about the fact that the people he brings to testify are being funded by oil?
Right. So I think, there's several things here. The first is that most mainstream media for at least 5 years now, if not longer, do not quote people from climate-denying organizations. That said, the climate-denying think tanks and even some of these scientists still get traction because, as we all know, there have been all of these very powerful echo chambers created on the American media landscape, including those that feed communities and people who don't accept climate change. That's the first thing. But even then, you know, you see polls that show, say, the majority of Americans accept that climate change is happening and want the government to do something about it. I mean, most of the resistance is like among the Tea Party of the Republican Party. But the fact that you have academics who produce science that's compromised by lack of disclosure, for example, or you have denier groups that are quoted somewhere or that they're producing, you know, they're at think tanks and producing reports. What that does is not so much affect public opinion as such. I mean, it does to a certain extent, but it gives cover to policymakers and to companies who don't want to take action on climate. You know, if you're a member of Congress, you can point to somebody like William Happer or Willie Soon and say, well, look, here's peer-reviewed research that says that climate change isn't happening. And so, you know, it's this sort of intellectual astroturf, if you will. Now, as far as people calling it out, I mean, I'd venture that a lot of people didn't even cover the conference, the hearing yesterday, but it lets, you know, but it nonetheless, this legitimacy is created, and things are on the congressional record that are just blatantly false.
And Elliot, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I did a 6-part series for the Huffington Post in May of 2013, and I looked at the coverage of climate and energy from January 2011 through December 2012. So I looked at 2 years of coverage, and I looked at how 8 major news organizations, including the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, NPR, Wall Street Journal, USA Today, Washington Post, I looked at how they covered it, and I looked at more than 1,000 articles, and I boiled it down to just less than 400. And I looked at how they covered 8 organizations that are funded by ExxonMobil and the Koch brothers, as well as other fossil fuel interests. And I found out that, for the most part, except for one group, the Americans for Prosperity, which was routinely cited as a Koch brother funded organization, most of the other organizations of the 8 that I looked at were rarely did the news the reporters ever mention that they were funded by fossil fuel interests. And more often than not, they were not, their specious arguments were not rebutted. So they were used in a false equivalency. They would say the climate scientists have found this, but Myron Ebell from the Competitive Enterprise Institute says that the climate models are not worth their salt, and that you can't listen to what they have to say. They would use these people as the other side of the story, and we all, journalists are always taught to give both sides of a story, so they would create this false equivalence between what the scientific community was saying with a spokesperson from an organization that's funded by either the Koch brothers or ExxonMobil or another fossil fuel organization. So, and only 32% of the time did I find that these news organizations bothered to mention in passing that these organizations were funded by fossil fuel interests. And then when it comes to certain organizations like the Heritage Foundation or the Manhattan Institute or the Cato Institute, Less than 10% of the time do they ever mention. Sometimes it was 3-4% of the time. So, in other words, these people were paid spokespeople by, they were paid by ExxonMobil to lie about climate change, climate science. They were quoted as reputable sources in major news organizations recording, and it basically helped enable it gave cover to politicians, as Neil was talking about, to do nothing. Mm. Oh, if so and so is quoted in the New York Times saying this, it gives it credibility. So I this series I did in Huffington Post shows that the mainstream news organizations were enablers. They gave a platform to disinformation that was funded by ExxonMobil and the Koch brothers and other fossil fuel interests. Now, Neil is correct. For the last couple of years, fortunately, we don't see these people being quoted as often. But when I looked at this, when I looked over those two-year period up through the end of 2012, they were getting quoted a lot.
We have a few emails about the interview with Ted Cruz and Steve Inskeep this morning. He denies climate change. How do you think the media should deal with people like Ted Cruz, Elliot? What questions should they ask?
I think they should find out where he's getting his money. Who funds his campaign?
Right.
Who does he talk to? That's one of my biggest complaints about the mainstream press. They will not say, Senator so-and-so, who gets funding from X, Y, and Z, had this to say about the issue that those companies care about. They don't do it. I do it all the time in my blogs in the Huffington Post, but mainstream news organizations don't do it. Neela might be able to explain why. She used to work for them, and I'm not blaming her at all, but I'm saying she used to work for mainstream news organizations, and what's the thinking there? Why won't they call out people and tell people where these representatives and senators get their money?
That's a good question. And so I worked for the LA Times for 4 years, and before that I worked for the New York Times. In both places I covered energy, but especially at the LA Times, where I covered it as covering the regulators and so on here in D.C. I think it's for a number of reasons. One is that the traditional or legacy media, my only experience is in newspapers, so I can't speak for broadcast, but they're not just writing for the web, but they're writing for actual physical print too, and that window is getting smaller and smaller. Excuse me. That there's not as much space, and so a lot of things are left out, right? So that's the first thing. I mean, I found that there were a lot of nuances, a lot of history, a lot of context that had to be left out because the stories were short, and for some reason, they were the same for print as for the web, and I think there's a legal issue there. But I think the other thing too is that another reason is that they probably felt that that if you're going to reveal, that Ted Cruz gets money from Americans for Prosperity, then you have to reveal that Sheldon Whitehouse gets money from Sierra Club Action or something, and they're like, where does this end, and what do we have to reveal, and so on. But I think the other thing too is that they're concerned about the newsrooms of newspapers get very nervous about what they think crosses a line into advocacy, and they, sometimes they err on the side of caution so much that they leave the wrong impression with readers, and they don't give a full enough picture. And I think it's just this institutional wariness. And I understand the impulse to protect their independence and to look like an honest broker, but sometimes there's such a reluctance or a timidity to be frank about things that it leaves readers without the kind of information they need.
According to the Center for Responsive Politics, during his presidential run, Ted Cruz has received about $500,000 from oil and gas, and during his 2012 Senate race, he raised about $750,000, according to the Center for Responsive Politics.
Right, and one thing about Ted Cruz, I have to say, is that I've spoken to people on the Hill, and there are a lot of people in the Republican Party who, from what I've heard from other members of Congress, from their peers, do accept that climate change is happening, but they're so scared of being primaried on the right after Citizens United that they, basically to protect their jobs, they won't come out and be accepting of it. I think you're starting to see changes in Congress there. But from what I've heard about Ted Cruz, I've heard that he's actually a true believer. Like, there are few people who are true believers, like him and Jim Inhofe and a couple of others, who really think all of this is a hoax, it's baloney. But he's, you know, so it's funny that we're focusing on Ted Cruz, obviously, because he's, you know, presidential candidate. He just had this interview on NPR. But he's not the best example of people being influenced by their funders. It's there's a lot of other people who are, and what they're afraid of is that guy or woman, you know, farther to the right, who will primary them, you know, and they point to their old colleague Bob Inglis from South Carolina, who is very conservative on all sorts of other indices, you know, gun control, abortion rights, and so on. But he accepted climate change, and he really, you know, and people ascribe his loss, I think it was in 2010, to that fact.
Well, another example is John McCain, Senator John McCain from Arizona. He co-sponsored a cap and trade bill back in 2004 or 5 or so with Senator Lieberman from Connecticut. He's not out there talking about dealing with climate change anymore because he's afraid of being attacked from the right.
Mm. That is Elliot Nagin. He's a senior writer with the Union of Concerned Scientists, and Neela Banerjee is a reporter with Inside Climate News. Today we are talking about ExxonMobil. In 1977, James Black, a senior scientist with Exxon, said that carbon dioxide from the world's use of fossil fuels would warm the planet and could eventually endanger humanity. How did Exxon keep that secret for so many years? What did other oil companies know? So far, the New York Attorney General is launching and has launched an investigation, and there are calls for other investigations. Senator Bernie Sanders wants the Attorney General Loretta Lynch to investigate corporate fraud at Exxon. And let's hear from Judy in Oakland. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm so grateful to the work that your guests have done uncovering the crimes of the oil industry, the fossil fuel industry. And I wanted to point out that even if we don't put them in jail, which is where I believe many of them belong, we are still taking away their social license. We are undermining, as this information comes out, their credibility is being continually undermined. This is where there is a parallel with the tobacco industry. And as that happens, as they try to defend their actions, more and more people are skeptical, and there'll be more ability to fight back against their power. So thank you very much. Oh, by the way, I'm hoping that California might join in this lawsuit. I don't know if Neela knows anything about the possibility, but I know there is some pressure on Kamala Harris to take them on. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Neela, do you have any information on that?
Well, first of all, thank you for your kind words. And secondly, we don't. We've been looking into it because California often does, you know, often pursues this kind of litigation and is often a partner with New York. So we know that a group, a citizens group called Climate Hawks, has accumulated signatures to present to the Attorney General to you know, asking for an inquiry into Exxon. So far, I mean, you know, people in, you know, at Attorney General's at Attorney's General offices play things pretty close to the vest, so we don't have any inside information, and we're not getting any indication so far, but it might change, or, you know, people may be just waiting around to see what the New York office turns up before they act, and I don't mean just California, but the Justice Department or the SEC. You know, they might be letting Schneiderman's office do all the heavy lifting.
Well, we'll definitely follow that. And Elliot, what do you think about Judy's comment about Exxon losing social capital? Because Bill McKibben wrote a damning piece in The Guardian saying this company, Exxon, had the singular capacity to change the course of world history for the better. And instead, it changed that course for the infinitely worse. In its greed, Exxon helped more than any other institution to kill our planet. So what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, I don't think that they're shivering in their boots only because people still have to buy gasoline to run their cars. Mm. So as long as and the federal government is still giving the oil and gas industry in tax breaks and subsidies $4.86 billion a year on average in today's dollars, and they've been getting that money since 1918. So we're still subsidizing the industry very heavily, And every time someone in Congress tries to introduce a bill to cut that subsidy, the industry's friends in Congress rise up and say, not going to happen. So the industry, regardless of what the public might think of ExxonMobil, they still have Congress. They have too many friends in Congress who they give money to, and it's not just ExxonMobil, it's other fossil fuel industries, fossil fuel companies. So their reputation may not be great, and their reputation was horrible when the Exxon Valdez spill happened. I mean, remember that? It was their reputation was dirt, but you know, it doesn't change public policy. That's what I'm saying.
Well, we have a question on subsidies from Ruby, who says, why is the U.S. still subsidizing Exxon? Indeed, why do we give massively profitable oil companies subsidies at all? And again, last year, net profit, according to Market Watch, net income was $32 billion. Neela, what about that? Have you asked politicians who support these subsidies, why are you giving this multi-billion-dollar corporation so many subsidies?
We haven't asked that question directly, but it's pretty obvious that, you know, when subsidies and tax breaks or anything else exist for fossil fuels or any other company, it's, you know, especially given the political clout of these industries, and it's just very hard to roll them back. I mean, nobody wants to go out and say, yeah, we're going to roll this back, or rather very few people do, and they're just, you know, they're not going to get the votes to do it. I mean, the House is run by oil-friendly Republicans, and there are not enough votes on the Senate side to push anything over. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you basically have a very powerful industry that has good friends in Congress who are not going to act on this.
Well, thank you for calling in, Judy. Let's go next to Eric in Berkeley. Hi, Eric. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm researching links between Koch Brothers, Exxon funding of conservative think tanks, and local campaigns to stop public transit expansion in cities where large projects are vulnerable to public opinion being swayed by disinformation. Cities I've identified where this has happened is Honolulu, actually the Bay Area, Albuquerque, and Austin, to name a few. And I'm wondering if Elliot, for one, could share any examples of specific think tanks that have been active on funding on the local level. This kind of disinformation against public transit is kind of a backdoor to suppress public investment that would decrease oil consumption. And maybe if he could describe how he finds the links of funding between conservative think tanks and these kinds of disinformation local politics on the kind of grassroots level. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Eric. Elliot?
Well, Eric, I'd love to hear from you after the show. I'm not aware of what ExxonMobil's doing at the local level. I will say that I just posted a piece on I've been posting pieces for the last couple of weeks, and I just posted a piece 2 days ago on the Huffington Post where at the end of it, I linked to a history of the company's funding since 1998. That information, Greenpeace and others have pulled that information together from the tax forms that the company has to file. There are also other public documents that the company has to file. Now, one thing that's interesting is that they also can hide this money, so we don't really know exactly how much money they've spent. We can only document roughly $30, $31 million since 1998, but one former ExxonMobil employee who remains anonymous because he's afraid to go public on this, but he's told us that the company from 1998 to 2005 on an annual basis spent as much as $10 million a year. My organization was able to, during that time frame, document $16 million. If it's $10 million a year, it's quite a bit more. Mm. And the company insiders called it black ops. So they figured out ways to hide the money when they were spending money on disinformation. As far as So the best place to go, there are places to go where you can find, there's a website called Conservative Transparency, where you can put in ExxonMobil, it'll tell you where they're spending its money. You can go to the Foundation Center online, and you can find the company's 990 forms, tax forms, so that's where you can find out what it's spending its money on.
Thank you for that information. We'll put those links at yourcallradio.org. We have just a couple minutes left. Neela, how did you first come across this 1977 email in which James Black, the senior scientist, talked about fossil fuels endangering humanity?
Well, we found out that Exxon had launched a big project that looked into they launched a big project that deployed one of their supertankers with equipment to measure CO2 concentrations in the ocean and in the atmosphere along its route, and that they'd done this in 1979. There's a peer-reviewed paper about the methodology out there on this. So from there, we ended up talking to the remaining authors who are still alive. One of them is a man named Ed Garvey, and you know he's on our website and so on. And from there, we just went from person to person, and we just did research in archives and just good old fashioned shoe leather amassed these papers. Hmm. And so that's basically how it was done.
Why we need investigative journalism. So what is next? What are you currently looking at?
Well, we continue to look at Exxon, and they, we're looking at the research that they've done. We're looking at some of the public policy arguments that they're making. We're looking more broadly at other fossil fuel companies. So, this can go in a lot of different directions. I mean, it's just things keep turning up, and we also have documents. We just our series was published from middle of September to about the middle of October, maybe late October, and we digitized more than 24 documents. But just like a week ago, I wrote a story based on 3 other documents, and we have lots of documents. And we're looking at them and sort of putting them in the context that we've already established, and we'll be issuing more documents, gradually, and explaining the significance to readers and letting them look at them themselves.
Neela Banerjee is a reporter with Inside Climate News, a nonprofit news organization. Elliot Nagin is a senior writer at the Union of Concerned Scientists, a nonprofit science advocacy organization. Thank you both for joining us, and thank you for your reporting.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll discuss which countries and cities are leading the way in renewable energy development. Green power is a major talking point at this week's climate change summit in Paris, but who's leading the charge to reduce their emissions? Uruguay just announced that 95% of its electricity is generated from renewables. So which countries and cities are succeeding in implementing renewable energy? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.